Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. We began the last episode with a quotation from the Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus. In that excerpt, Ammianus described how the Goths, one of the barbarian peoples who lived beyond the empire's frontiers, were driven to the Danube River, the border between the Roman world and what lay beyond. The Romans were happy to let the Goths in that fateful year of 376 AD, seeing them as a potential source of new recruits for the army. According to Ammianus, this was the beginning of the end for the Roman Empire. Quote, "With such stormy eagerness on the part of insistent men," he wrote in hindsight, "was the ruin of the Roman world brought in." That's the Roman view on these events. Within 2 years, the Goths would be in open rebellion against the Romans. They would defeat a Roman army in open battle and leave an emperor dead on the battlefield. 30 years later, in 410 AD, these people and their descendants would capture and sack the city of Rome itself. From that point, the end of the empire inevitably followed. That's the view most modern historians have been happy to adopt. After all, this is the date that we've chosen as the starting point for this podcast, too, so I'm every bit as guilty as my compatriots. But it's easy to lose sight of the barbarians themselves in all of this talk about the long-term ramifications of theirs and the Romans' actions. Why did they come to the empire? Why, 2 years later, were the Goths in open rebellion against the Romans, and how did they destroy an entire Roman army and leave an emperor dead on the battlefield? What happened during this rebellion? What led to the Goths sacking Rome some 30 years in the future? And how did they end up holding a large chunk of southern France as an independent territory shortly after that? Think about that for a moment. In less than 40 years, the Goths went from refugees begging for entry into the empire to the first group of barbarians to establish their own kingdom within its borders. They did something that no other group had done in the entirety of Roman history, or at least it seems that way in hindsight. On many occasions before this, barbarians had entered the borders of the empire, but before this, they had practically always been either driven off back beyond the frontiers, captured and/or slaughtered wholesale, or assimilated en masse. Instead, this time the Goths won. That's a stunning shift in fortunes by any measure, and that story is what we'll be focusing on in this episode and the one that follows. More specifically, we're going to attempt to answer a potentially unanswerable question. How did the Goths themselves experience these events? We'll focus on the preamble to the Goths' entry into the empire in this episode. We'll examine what life was like beyond the frontier. The Goths didn't show up to cross the Danube as a blank, barbarous slate. They were sophisticated people with a long history of interaction with the empire and their own history and traditions. And that is what we're going to explore here today. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. Now, this is all easier said than done. In general, it's impossible to escape the Roman perspective on the barbarians. The barbarians have left us no written records of their own. We can't crack open a history or understand how they felt about being driven, in many cases, from their homelands. Their religious beliefs are more or less a mystery. Our understanding of their social structure and culture features more questions than answers, if we're being honest with ourselves. Even deriving some sort of basic sequence of events in the lands beyond the Roman frontier is difficult. It's far, far too easy to just fill in those huge gaps in our knowledge with uncritical acceptance of what the Romans had to say, not that much of that survives either. Even the collective term we use, barbarians, is rooted in the Roman view of themselves as the civilized people in opposition to those who lived outside their world. There's a term for this that historians use, the interpretatio Romana, the Roman interpretation, or more precisely, the Roman distortion. This slant on things is so pervasive that we can even forget that it's there. But rather than view what the Romans wrote as unvarnished truth or objective descriptions of what they heard, we have to remember that they were attempting to translate an alien culture and foreign norms and behaviors into terms that they themselves could understand. Moreover, the Romans had their own conventions and prejudicial ideas that helped to dictate how they thought about the barbarians. These were ideas that stretched back centuries with histories of their own, and they exerted a profound influence on what the Romans wrote. For example, many Romans who wrote about the Goths called them Scythians, because that's what Greek and Roman writers had called the people who lived beyond the Danube for 800 years. The barbarians may have changed, but in the Roman viewpoint, they never really did. They existed outside of history, an eternal, unchanging force, living outside the borders and opposed in every meaningful way to civilization itself, as represented by the Greeks and the Romans. If you're an American, you've probably seen a Western movie or two at some point in your life. Me, I love Westerns. They form a particular genre that has its own conventions and stock characters. Gunfights on dusty streets, the mysterious stranger, heroes in white hats, villains in black hats. Now think about the portrayal of Native Americans in those movies. For the most part, those portrayals fall into two categories: the dangerous, uncivilized savage, or the noble outsider, whose character serves as a mirror to the corruption and unnoticed savagery of 19th century America. The Romans saw the barbarians in much the same terms. They were either a danger lurking beyond the borders, the antithesis of civilization, or in rare cases they were the noble reflection of Rome's decadence, impurity, and unworthiness. But the reality, of course, was far more complex and ambiguous, just as it was with Native Americans on the 19th century frontier. We forget all of that at our peril. So we're going to try something a little different here. While the world beyond the Roman frontier is hard to access without much in the way of written evidence, the archaeological record does have a very great deal to tell us about the material circumstances of the barbarians' lives. There are also some written texts that speak to the barbarians' world, and we can use them judiciously, bearing in mind that pervasive Roman influence and perspective. Once the Goths enter the empire, we'll try to consciously see events from their point of view. The underlying thing that I want to get at here is that the barbarians were real people. Their lives and experiences were real. They weren't unthinking savages driven by an unthinking desire to tear down everything the Romans had built. Their motivations and desires were far more complex, subtle, and, well, human. The Romans and barbarians were friends, trading partners, political allies, and tooth and claw enemies all at the same time. Now, as I mentioned, we use barbarians as a collective term for the peoples living beyond the boundaries of the empire, but there was a tremendous amount of diversity within that broad label. The ocean-going Saxons, who lived along the cold, wet, sandy shore of the North Sea in the present-day Netherlands and Germany, shared little in common with the horse-riding, nomadic Sarmatians who occupied the lush, grassy Hungarian plain between the Carpathian Mountains and the Danube. Their languages belonged to entirely different families. The Saxons' language belonged to the Germanic family and was probably a forerunner of modern English. The tongue the Sarmatians spoke belonged to a nearly extinct branch of the Iranian family, which contains languages like Farsi, Kurdish, and Pashto. The Saxons were a seagoing people who raided far and wide on wooden ships, while the Sarmatians raided on horseback. Their religious beliefs, to the extent that we understand them, varied widely as well. The Sarmatians generally practiced cranial deformation, binding the heads of infants to lengthen their skulls, while the Saxons, as far as we know, left babies' heads well enough alone. Now, those were just two of the many tribal groupings that sat just outside the boundaries of the empire. We could also mention the Franks along the middle of the Rhine River, who eventually came to dominate Gaul and gave their name to modern France, the Alemanni along the Rhine and the Upper Danube, who for a time presented the biggest threat to the Roman Empire, even if they're not remembered as much today, the Burgundians, from whom we get Burgundy, the Suebi, who gave Germany the region of Swabia and set up a kingdom in Spain for more than a century, the Frisians along the North Sea coast, and last but certainly not least, the Goths. Now, those are just the groups that actually impinged on the borders of the empire. At greater distance were the Lombards, the Vandals, the Jutes, the Angles, and of course the fearsome Huns, all of whom had their role to play in the events to come. Those are just the major and well-known groupings. There were dozens of others, Rugians, Herulians, Scyrians, Gepids, and many more that appeared and disappeared in the relative blink of an eye. Any attempt to impose some kind of unity or homogeneity on this diverse and complex world is wrong-headed in the extreme. We'll talk more about the rest of those groupings in time, but for this week, let's focus on the Goths and their journey. More specifically, we're going to focus on the journey of one particular Goth. It's easy to lose sight in all of this talk about literary stereotypes and migrations and wars and diverse cultures of individual people. It's even easier because among the Romans, let alone among the illiterate Goths, people in this period didn't write biography. If people told their life story, they did so orally, and none of those records have come down to us. And yet, the necessity of humanizing these processes remains. So we're going to try something like a thought experiment, focusing on one single Goth who might have lived through all the events I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, being born beyond the frontier, migrating into Roman territory, fighting Roman armies, sacking Rome, and eventually settling in southern France. Now, we might not know them, but real people did make that incredible journey. We're just going to have to use our imaginations to wrap our heads around it.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So let's pick a date for this hypothetical Goth of ours to be born. A good one for our purposes is 340 AD. That's about 35 years prior to the Goths' migration, making him a fully grown adult by the time that process took place. We'll make our Goth a male, simply because men were more mobile than women in these societies, and for the sake of simplicity, we know a great deal more about Gothic men than women. Let's call him Vulfila, Little Wolf. That was a common name among the Goths. The missionary who had brought Christianity beyond the frontier went by Ulfilas, another way of saying the same thing. He would have had male peers with names like Aldiarix, Ermanigild, Fritigern, and Jurik. So where would Vulfila have been born? The area in which the Goths lived beyond the frontier stretched over a vast region, from central Romania in the west to the easternmost tip of the Ukraine in the east. More specifically, that region describes a particularly diverse archaeological culture that scholars call the Santana de Mures-Cherniakov culture. The name comes from the two most distant points bearing this assembly of goods, 800 miles from west to east. Now, it's a little more complicated than this. You can't look at a piece of broken pottery, or a brooch, or a belt buckle, or a cremation urn and say, yep, you know what, that's a Gothic brooch. A bull doesn't tell you what ethnic group the person or persons who owned it thought they belonged to. Most of the archaeological remains that we have come from cemeteries or settlements, and what you find in a grave or house just doesn't necessarily have all that much to say about how these people conceived of their identity. This has been a major debate among historians and archaeologists, and it's mostly boring and surprisingly angry. A bunch of stuffy old dudes have gotten really, really mad about this stuff in the last 30 years or so, and have spent a lot of time declaring that, in fact, they're not really mad, it's the other guys who were mad. And of course, at one point, one side took pains to point out the other side's roots in Nazi-influenced ideas about how cultures and history work, proving that even academics aren't immune to Godwin's Law. It's an arcane and frankly a stupid, hyperbolic debate filled with personal insults and decades-long feuds between some genuinely unpleasant people. Trust me, I've met them and I saw one of the major players in this debate make a graduate student giving a paper at a conference cry just for funsies. As silly as it is, though, it does have some important implications for our Goth, Vulfila. What did he believe made him a Goth? Where did he think his people came from? In other words, how did the Goths define themselves in relation to the people who lived around them? What set them apart from any of the dozens of other groups who lived beyond the frontier, and what set them apart in their minds from the Romans? Ethnicity, this feeling of belonging to a group, it turns out, is situational. What makes someone a Goth, or for that matter an American, differs from context to context. Being a Goth among Romans was much different than being a Goth beyond the frontier, just like being an American in Europe is much different than being an American surrounded by Americans. Among your own people, you might not notice the little things that mark you out as a member of that group, but to outsiders, things like language, religious belief, dress, and hairstyle can all serve those functions. We just don't know much about that as far as the Goths are concerned because, as we said, the gods you worship or the language you speak or the hairstyle you wear aren't visible on shards of pottery or belt buckles, the kinds of things that we find in archaeological sites. But we do know that Roman observers repeatedly said that the Goths lived in roughly the area covered by the Santana de Mores Cherniakov culture. So we can be fairly sure of the material world in which our Goth, Vulfila, grew up. Here's what we know about that society. First and foremost, it was tremendously diverse. It's 800 miles from Santana de Mores to Cherniakov, and that environment included the Carpathian Mountains, lush farmland around the Danube, swampy river basins, and part of the Great Eurasian Steppe, the land of the horse-riding nomads. The Goths probably weren't the only ethnic group that belonged within that archaeological culture, though they seem to have politically dominated the region. By the time of Vulfila's birth, the Goths had been a going concern in this region for about 150 years. The Goths may have migrated from present-day Sweden, but that's a pretty controversial topic, and it's not really one that we need to be concerned with here. What's more concrete is that the Goths emerged from around the beginning of the 3rd century in Roman sources, and that's roughly when this particular assembly of goods and practices, the ones that make up the Santana de Mures Cherniakov archaeological culture, all show up in the archaeological record. The Goths, and this associated archaeological culture, grow out of the context of the Roman frontier. I mentioned at length in the first episode that we can't really understand the barbarian world and the Roman world as two separate things. They were inherently connected, and they grew and responded to one another. This is a major theme of this episode, and it's one to bear in mind as we continue. So, for example, it's not an accident that the Goths first enter the historical record in connection with a time of massive upheaval in the Roman world. Following the murder of the emperor Alexander Severus at the hands of his own troops in 235 AD, the empire descended into chaos. In 238, six different men laid claim to the title of emperor, and it was in precisely this year that the first secure record of the Goths appears. They raided the city of Histria at the mouth of the Danube along the Black Sea, and then withdrew when they were paid off. The Goths show up again 15 years later, sacking the city of Marcianople, a bit south and west of Histria in modern-day Bulgaria. They raid it again the next year further south, and then they cross the Black Sea in boats to raid Asia Minor, like modern-day Turkey. For the next 20 years, until the 270s, they raided Asia Minor and south of the Danube in increasingly destructive waves. Finally, the Goths were driven back the other direction, and for a time, their raids ceased. We don't hear much about them for the next 50 years or so, but by the 320s, the lower Danube, the part near the Black Sea, was known as the Ripa Gothica, the Gothic Bank, in Latin. At around the same time, Greek speakers had started to call the land beyond the Danube Gothia, the land of the Goths. It's in this period that we next meet the Goths, and they appear to be both much more powerful and much more integrated into the Roman world. More Roman artifacts appear along archaeological deposits along the barbarian side of the Danube, and more Roman coins, too. This means that trade increased, and it's likely that emperors and Roman officials were paying direct subsidies to Gothic chieftains and kings in return for soldiers to fight in the Roman army and for waging war against other barbarian groups beyond the frontier. It was cheaper to pay one barbarian king to keep the others in line than it was to fight all of them all the time, and the Goths were the beneficiaries of this policy between the 270s and the 320s or so. This piece about troops is important too, and we'll come back to it throughout today's episode. Emperors needed soldiers, and it was increasingly hard to recruit them from within the empire as the 3rd century turned into the 4th. What was the solution? Well, right beyond the frontiers was a large pool of trained warriors who were happy to join the army either as individuals or as something like mercenaries subcontracted by a barbarian king or chieftain. The Emperor Constantine is famous for being the first to adopt Christianity, and also as the founder of the great city of Constantinople. To achieve sole rulership over the empire, he defeated another contender named Licinius. Both the army of Constantine and the army of Licinius were formed in large part of men recruited from beyond the Danube. In essence, to some extent, Constantine and Licinius were competing for the same pool of military talent. Shortly thereafter, in the early 330s, Constantine concluded a crushingly successful military campaign against the Goths beyond the Danube. He imposed a formal treaty on the Goths in the year 332, one of the first formal agreements of this kind between the Romans and a barbarian group. It opened the entire Danube border to trade between Goths and Romans, and before this, that kind of exchange had been really tightly regulated. Moreover, and more important, this further opened the pool of Gothic manpower to Roman military recruitment. The Gothic side of the Danube, in other words, became more tightly integrated into the Roman world, even more so than it already had before. So this was the world into which our friend Vulfila was born around 340. For the sake of simplicity, let's say he was born in roughly the middle of this Santana de Mures Cherniakov archaeological zone, the one where the Goths dominated. He'd be north of the Danube, but not far, somewhere in the broad, rolling plains and gentle hills just to the east of the Carpathian Mountains. This was a world of villages and towns, not cities, but even if Vulfila would have been born 100 miles from the border, the influence of the Roman world would have been pervasive. For example, archaeologists have found as many bronze Roman coins, the kind you would use for day-to-day financial transactions, on the Gothic side as on the Roman side. Goths in Vulfila's village would have used Roman ceramics and glassware, they would have drank Roman wine, and, as we mentioned, they would have used Roman money for all their needs. Many of the older men would have been veterans of the Roman army who'd returned home after their service, and Vulfila would have known young men who had left home to fight for glory and pay. Between the Roman merchants they dealt with and the number of military veterans, it's likely that a great many people in Vulfila's village would have spoken Latin in addition to their native Gothic and whatever else they spoke. So what did that village look like? Well, it would have consisted in large part of two different kinds of houses. Most would be round, sunken huts, half dug into the ground and made of wood or wattle and daub. Others would be big wooden structures built entirely above ground. These stall houses had space inside for both livestock and people. All of these dwellings were built in neat rows along a main street within the village. If an important man, a king or a chieftain lived there, then he might have had a larger timber hall of his own. Fields of millet, barley, and wheat surrounded these villages, and cattle, sheep, goats, and pigs were the most common domestic animals. On the more open plains of the steppe to the east, some groups of Goths might have led a more pastoral than settled existence, moving herds of horses and cattle from place to place. Vulfila's world was a diverse one. Not everyone who lived within this Gothic world was a Goth. There were Iranian-speaking Sarmatians, Latin-speaking Dacians, and many other groups besides, though the Goths were the politically dominant ones. There were different groups of Goths, too. Those living further to the east in the modern-day Ukraine called themselves Greutungi, something like steppe dwellers. Those to the west, the group to which Vulfila belonged, called themselves Tervingi, which might mean more like forest dwellers. There were almost certainly others under this broader Gothic label whose names have been lost to us. This wasn't a static world. Things were changing beyond the frontiers, and Rome had a lot to do with that. The Gothic world was becoming more stratified. The rich were getting richer, and the powerful were becoming more powerful. Now, some Roman writers had described an egalitarian barbarian world, with a broad class of free farmers who held land, did military service, and participated in the political life of the tribe. And even today, there are still a few historians who would argue that this was the case. To put my cards on the table, though, I think this is totally wrong. What we see in the archaeological record is an increasingly powerful elite group. And in the scattered written texts that we have, war bands that owed allegiance to powerful lords and kings. If that egalitarian world of free farmers had ever actually existed, and I'm not convinced that it did, it was gone by the middle of the 4th century in the Gothic lands. So instead, what we see is an increasingly powerful, wealthy aristocracy. In this diverse culture, it's a safe bet that the Goths formed most of that aristocracy, and they probably exercised control over the other ethnic groups who inhabited the area. In terms of the ethnic identity that we discussed beforehand, to be a Goth was probably to be one of these powerful people, and that power rested on military participation and military force. Now, we talked about the interconnections between the Roman world and the Goths' world beyond the borders. Even if those trends toward a more top-heavy society, maybe a more militarized society, had their roots in things that happened beyond the border, the Romans exacerbated them. How? Well, remember when I talked about the Romans choosing some barbarian chieftains and kings to subsidize over others? What do you think they did with all that money, which archaeologists have found in massive hoards of silver coinage as far as 500 miles from the border? Well, they used some of it to build fortified towns with walls and ditches around their large timber halls. Places like this would have been centers of these lords and chieftains' power. Some of these big men even built Roman-style villas for themselves, an emulation of the kinds of houses they'd seen when they were fighting for or against the Romans south of the border. Archaeologists have found one home in the Moldovan village of Sobati, nearly 300 miles from the border, that even had glass windows and 16 Roman-style columns supporting a roof made of terracotta tiles, just like any self-respecting Roman country gentleman. They imported Roman ceramics and drank huge quantities of Roman wine, shipped in the distinctive pottery amphorae that you can still find in any archaeological site from this period beyond the border. The visual language of this elite's power was a Roman one. They wore jewelry made inside the empire and carried weapons made by Roman blacksmiths. The other major thing they did with all that money, though, was bind a war band to them. Any leader worth his salt needed warriors, and warriors in the world beyond the frontier didn't fight for free. By subsidizing these leaders, the Romans allowed them to create more effective military forces. Then, when the Romans needed soldiers, these leaders could hire out individual soldiers or units to an emperor in need of troops to fight a Roman usurper, or some frontier general who fancied himself the next emperor. These barbarian rulers, kings, chieftains, judges, whatever the terminology happened to be, weren't above raiding into Roman lands even when they might have been party to a peace treaty. Their relationship with the Romans was subject to constant renegotiation from both sides, and the Romans were happy to return the favor, provoked or not.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
So let's return to the example of our friend Volfila. This was his world, the world of a war band in service to a king or lord or chieftain, whatever term he might have used for them. War was probably something like his occupation. Remember, his father's and grandfather's and great-grandfather's generations had all fought the Romans and others beside, so our Volfila would have grown up surrounded by stories of his ancestors' deeds and raids and battles. Even if he hadn't fought Romans, there were plenty of others to fight. The Vandals, who would one day conquer Spain and North Africa, were something like the ancestral enemies of the Goths, according to a much later source. The Iranian-speaking Sarmatians were another potential foe, and we know the Goths fought them regularly as well. In short, there were plenty of opportunities for a young warrior to make his way in the world. He was familiar with the Roman world's material manifestations, its coins, its jewelry, its wine, and its pottery. He had seen Roman soldiers come beyond the frontier and met Roman merchants. If this were Vulfila's world, if he belonged to this social class of Goths defined by their military prowess and skills, then it's basically certain that he would have spent some time in the Roman army. He probably wouldn't have been a long service type of soldier, the kind who joined on his own and did a 20 or 25 year stint before settling for good in Roman territory, but more likely one attached to a short-term obligation. If he were born in 340, he would have been of military age by the middle of the 350s. If that's when he wound up in the Roman army, he might have traveled to Gaul to fight the barbarian Alemanni who had crossed the Rhine and invaded, or maybe the Franks and Saxons in the north of Gaul. All of those barbarian groups felt the sharp end of Roman power during this brief period. The Emperor Constantius fought the Persians in the late 350s, and his successor Julian led a massive invasion in 363. We're not sure about Julian, but Constantius definitely had Gothic troops in that army. The Goths man forts along the Danubes, too, and their belt buckles and brooches and jewelry are common archaeological finds in the Roman territory south of the river. Vulfila, then, had fought in the Roman army, just like many of his compatriots. He might have fought anywhere between the forests of Germany beyond the Rhine and the deserts of Persia, or anywhere in between. For 5 or 10 years, depending on the arrangement he or his aristocratic lord had made with the Romans, the tightly disciplined and organized world of the army would have been his home. He learned a disciplined and organized way of fighting, probably on horseback. The Romans liked barbarian cavalry, and the Goths had become excellent horsemen. Vulfila saw siege engines like catapults, ballistas, and mobile siege towers. He experienced military engineering on an epic scale. He saw trim, well-built frontier forts and huge city walls. He may have grown to like, or to hate, the Romans themselves. If he hadn't already, he learned Latin, or at least the rough army dialect that was heavily spiced with words from the Germanic languages beyond the frontier. And then Vulfila, like many other Goths who had served in the army, returned home. He did so in the middle of the 360s as a man in his mid-20s, just when relations between the Goths and the Romans were breaking down on a large scale. I mentioned before the peace treaty that the Emperor Constantine had forced on the Goths in the 330s, the one that opened up the border to trade and the Goths to greater Roman military recruitment, but it really did function as a peace treaty as well. For 30 years, there were no large-scale wars between the Goths and the Romans. That changed in 365. The Goths contributed troops to the cause of an imperial usurper named Procopius, who tried to overthrow the Emperor Valens, a villain and incompetent with whom we'll spend a great deal more time in next week's episode. The Gothic leaders and kings who had thrown their weight behind Procopius were rewarded with money, but Valens intercepted the troops, and they never got to Procopius. Valens defeated the usurper shortly thereafter and had him executed. Now Valens, as you might imagine, wasn't too happy about the Goths' involvement in a Roman civil war, so he set about teaching them a lesson. In 367, he took an army across the Danube. Valens didn't really get much done. According to our friend Ammianus Marcellinus, Valens sent, quote, plundering bands and seized some of the families which could be captured before they reached the steep and winding mountain regions and while they were still wandering over the level plains. And after having attained only this, which was what chance offered him, he returned harmlessly with his men, without having inflicted or suffered serious harm. Valens got even less done the next year, and it was only in 369 that he succeeded in bringing his army beyond the Danube and launching a real campaign. He defeated the Gothic leader Athanaric in battle and managed to force a peace, one that ended the previously free trade across the border and the diplomatic payments that Gothic leaders had come to rely on. Our friend Vulfila participated in this campaign, and we have to imagine that much of the Goths' army was made up of men like him who had been on the other side, doing exactly the same thing to Alemanni or Franks beyond the Rhine frontier. In the aftermath of this war, this Gothic leader Athanaric did something interesting. He began a persecution of Christians living among the Goths. Remember, we talked about the diversity of Gothic society. There were Goths, sure, but there were also Roman descendants of slaves the Goths had taken during their raids on Asia Minor and the lands to the south of the Danube, and many other groups besides. Many of those Romans were Christians, and it was during this period that Goths proper began to convert as well. A martyr story from this period describes a saint named Saba as, quote, a Goth by race and living in Gothia. This Saba, who lived in the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains close to where we located our friend Wolfila, went out of his way to get himself martyred. A close reading of this text, which took place during Athanaric's persecution, reveals that the people of Saba's village would have been happy to ignore the orders to root out Christians. When the inspectors came, Saba's fellow villagers swore up and down that there weren't any Christians living among them, but Saba spoke out anyway. Even then, the officials would have been happy to let it go. Saba couldn't keep his mouth shut, though, and insulted a lord named Atharid. The martyr story describes Atharid as, quote, the son of Rothesteus of royal rank, and said he led, quote, a gang of lawless bandits. Remember earlier how we discussed those elites who built fancy houses and fortified settlements and imported Roman wine and glass? That sounds, to me at least, a lot like Atharid here, and this gang of lawless bandits sounds a lot like the kind of warrior following to which someone like our friend Wulfila might have belonged. Saba made sure he got himself martyred in horrifying fashion. The Christians in his community made sure that his body went south, into the Roman territory beyond the Danube. Once again, the connections between what happened within the empire and in the territory of the barbarians is crystal clear. The ties of religious faith bound together Christians within the Gothic lands and within the empire. It was around this time, the early 370s, that another player entered the game. If you've ever heard of a group of barbarians, you've probably heard of the Huns, and it's at exactly this time that they appear in the record. Our friend Ammianus Marcellinus was probably reporting rumors he heard when he said that they, quote, exceed every degree of savagery. Here's how Ammianus described them. Quote, they all have compact, strong limbs and thick necks and are so monstrously ugly and misshapen that one might take them for two-legged beasts or for the stumps, rough-hewn into images that are used in putting sides to bridges. But although they have the form of men, however ugly, they are so hardy in their mode of life that they have no need of fire nor of savory food, but eat the roots of wild plants and the half-raw flesh of any kind of animal whatever, which they put between their thighs and the backs of their horses, and thus warm a little. That's terrifying stuff, right? It's no wonder that that in the basic story you've probably heard, this group of newcomers defeated the Goths and drove them as refugees to the banks of the Danube, where they would enter Roman territory and bring doom with them. As always, though, things were a little more complicated than this. First of all, as we've discussed, there were multiple groups of Goths in play here. The Greuthungi, the steppe-dwelling Goths of the east, modern-day Ukraine, probably fought the Huns for years before they became known to people like Ammianus Marcellinus. It was only when the Greuthungi fled west and involved the Tervingi, the group of Goths whom the king Athanaric ruled and to whom our friend Wulfila belonged, that things became really serious. The Huns apparently inflicted a serious defeat on them, and the Tervingi fled to the Carpathians for safety. They abandoned Athanaric and fled from there to the Danube, where we pick up our story in 376. The Huns chose exactly the right time to invade. That Roman invasion of the Gothic lands that Valens had led between 367 and 369 had shattered Athanaric's power. A secure king, for example, doesn't feel the need to persecute Christians. And remember, one condition of that treaty had shut down the previously widespread trade between the empire and the Gothic lands. The subsidies that Gothic lords had used to pay their military followings were gone too. So the Goths were hurting economically and were under a king whose reputation had been shot by military defeat and a terrible treaty. The lords didn't have the money to pay their warriors. Now, we don't know much about the Huns at this point, but there's no reason to think they were stupid. This was a good time to fight the Goths. Now, it's not like all the Goths everywhere were either killed by the Huns or forced to become refugees, just the Tervingi, and maybe not even all of them. The Ostrogoths, whom we'll meet a century or so down the road, were the descendants of the Goths who had stayed behind. There were even Gothic speakers in isolated parts of the Crimean Peninsula until the 18th century. Modern historians tend to downplay the scale of the Huns' invasion and the number of Goths who fled to the Roman Empire, and they're probably not wrong to do so. Still, for those who did flee, this must have been an incredibly traumatic event. Put yourself in our friend Wulfila's shoes. He's been a warrior all his life, and he's just now edging into middle age. He's getting a little bit old, he's not quite as strong or as quick as he once was, and a lifetime of horseback riding, fighting, and hard labor is taking its toll. He has scars on his face and injuries that have never healed right. He's starting to get arthritis in his hands. But still, he's good at what he does. You don't survive a lifetime of war, 20 years of fighting against Franks and Alemanni and Persians and Romans, without being both very lucky and very good at what you do. Now, just as you're ready to settle down and leave all that behind you, the Huns arrive. They arrive on horseback, out of nowhere, seemingly. They burn your village. They kill your friends and your family. Others they take captive to be slaves in the lands to the east. Your lifetime of experience as a soldier has come to nothing. So, you flee to the mountains. You ditch the worthless king Athanaric. He failed to defeat the Romans. He ruined 30 years of prosperous trade and integration with the Roman frontier, and now he's failed to defeat the Huns, too. But remember what we've talked about today. For men like Vulfila, who probably had his family with him, the Roman world isn't some alien, unfamiliar place. The Romans need soldiers, and the Goths can fight, so why not make a deal with them? This is what the new Gothic chieftain, Fritigern, suggested. After all, Goths who had served in the army had seen or heard of groups of barbarians being peacefully settled within the empire in return for military service. This was a common enough thing, it's how the empire got a great many of its soldiers. Why couldn't it be for the Goths, too? But that's only a solution that makes sense in the context of familiarity with the empire, and more specifically, with the Roman army. It was with this in mind that the mass of Gothic refugees showed up on the Danube in 376. This is where we'll leave our story, and Vulfila's, for this week. Next time, we'll follow the Goths as they enter the empire, defeat Valens at the epic Battle of Adrianople, and settle for 2 decades within Roman territory. Eventually, though, they'll be on the move again. The sack of Rome and the birth of a Gothic kingdom in southern France await. Thank you so much for joining me for today's episode of The Fall of Rome. If you've enjoyed today's show, please leave a rating and a review on the platform of your choice. And if you really want to help me out, you can take the survey at wondery.com/survey. That's wondery.com/survey. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. I'm always happy to chat, so drop me a line anytime. Until next time, thank you for joining me.